Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Donald R. Prothero, paleontology and geology researcher, teacher, author. He is adjunct professor of geological sciences at California State Polytechnic University in Pomona. And we're talking about his latest book, The Story of Evolution in 25 Discoveries, The Evidence and the People Who Found It.
When you're ready.
Don, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again, especially about this book.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You know, when I heard about this book, first of all, knowing that you wrote it, I knew it was going to be interesting. But instead of focusing on 25 exact fossils, which would sort of seem to be the obvious thing to do, instead, what you did, which is what was sort of really interesting and brilliant about this book, is you chose 25 ideas, concepts that were that led to us to understand how evolution is and works. And what brought, why did you do that?
Yeah, this actually emerged from an earlier idea I'd had for a book. I wanted to write something that was even more popular and more catchy. There's a book out there called Evolution WTF, which is sort of just, you know, just images of strange things that nature does, you know, with the sort of like a chuckle, you know, that they're why did nature do weird things? But of course, because nature doesn't always have a lot of sense. It's not designed. It just happens. And so that had the same effect, but it was not nearly as scholarly or really employing. So I was thinking of doing something along those lines, but with just short vignettes of dozens of examples of evidence for evolution, because this is something that, to a great degree, and no matter what you write about evolution, most people don't realize just how much evidence there is for it and how it comes from aspect of biology and geology.
Now, people may be surprised, but the first two chapters have to do with space and time. And,
right.
You know, you and I think people, what? Why would he do that? But it really has to do with how humanity had to start rethinking who we were in the universe.
Right.
Talk about that. Because initially people thought we were God's creation. You know, we were the ultimate creation.
Right.
We were the center of the universe. The stars were just sort of a celestial vault that was above our heads. But the changing the thinking about those two things were essential to understanding evolution.
That's correct. Yeah, there's 2,000 years of having a very short time frame and following biblical chronology. The earth was very young and it was created as we see it, had never been changing, and any changes you saw were due to erosion, which was usually attributed to Adam's sin, which is interesting. And all of this basically made it impossible for people to see what was right in front of them until the framework of everything changed. Of course, the idea of geologic time was still new when Darwin was a kid. He grew up with it, of course, and then by the time he was on the voyage to the Beagle, he was taught by, he had been taught by Adam Sedgwick, the first professor of geology anywhere in the world, and they were already losing their belief in biblical short timescales. And then, of course, he became a convinced follower of Charles Lyell, who was the founder of pretty much modern geology in the real sense, whose books he actually read as he was at sea. And so they became one of the first zoologists to see another part of the world, in this case South America, and much of the other world is traveled all the way around the world, as a matter of fact, but mostly South America, with Lyellian gradualism and Lyellian time frames and all the, you know, the naturalistic viewpoint that Lyell gave him. And so this is very much what made Darwin think the way he did when he came back and he started to put his ideas together. And that would not have been possible even 20 or 30 years before that.
That's right.
I mean, when James Hutton started modern geology in the 1780s, they had no real, you know, idea what they were doing, and his ideas that the geologic time was immense, you know, no vestige of the beginning was a phrase he used, was radical, and it wasn't easy to accept, and it was really Lyell who brought it to people's attention, and eventually people began to get numbers on the age of the Earth, but that wasn't until the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, so...
Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on Darwin. You do, and it's important that people read about it, but I just want to talk about one aspect of Darwin and his great trip on the Beagle. Darwin's finches. People have never heard of Darwin's finches before. Can you explain why they're so critical to understanding evolution?
Yeah, what struck Darwin on all of his voyage to the Beagle was how many different kinds of things he was finding that were not found anywhere in Eurasia, and especially weird things that were new to science, and many of which he collected and were described by him, not just living animals, but also the first fossils ever taken from South America that were adequately described, which he brought back. And then the famous Richard Owen, who coined the name Dinosauria, was the man who described Darwin's fossils. And I've actually seen those and touched those at the British Museum. But anyway, the whole thing was that he had this big insight because he was one of the first people to see extinct animals from another continent and all the weird animals of South America that had no counterparts, so his biogeographic framework expands. And then when he gets to a place like the Galapagos, you know, he would think, well, he expected to be populated by the same kinds of birds that live just, you know, a few hundred miles offshore in South America. But instead, there's all these niches, for example, for beak that would crush shells like nuthatches and so on. They're all done by finches. In fact, Darwin himself didn't realize they were all finches when he collected them and brought them home. It was an ornithologist named John Gould who started working on the collection that Darwin let him work on to study that realized that finches had devolved into all these other kinds of things, and that really got Darwin thinking about that. Once he got home, he didn't realize at the time he was in the islands. In fact, it's been traced down. It turned out he didn't keep very good records, so they had to reconstruct where he got them from only after Gould told him that they were all very different, and they were not other kinds of birds. They were finches that had become like other kinds of birds. So this, you know, opened Darwin's mind, the idea of things change from one ancestral species to another, and that really broke the prevailing idea at the time, which was that species were unchanged.
And what's interesting, what people may not know, is more contemporary people still studied Darwin's finches, and I'm thinking of the Grants.
Oh, that's right.
The Grants. Talk about them.
Yeah, so, you know, the Darwin's finch example, of course, which was in his original book and amplified by several other editions, then was picked up. And so there's famous studies by Lack and by others, ornithologists, early 20th century. But the people who did the most were Peter and Rosemary Grant, who are now, well, I think one's passed away now, but they were at Princeton their whole lives. And yet most of their life was spent on one island in the Galapagos, Daphne Major. And they basically camped there most of the year. And when they did so, they got to know every single bird personally on that island because they would catch them in mist nets, you know, and they have a little tag on it so they knew which bird was which, and they would repeatedly weigh them and track that birds were, you know, born in the next generation. And they basically watched evolution happen on a fairly short time scale, year by year. And so they were the first, for example, to document that when they had drought years on this island, that the thicker-billed versions of the ground finch had survived and been much more common in the next generation because they were able to eat those hardly any of the food but the old seeds that had opened up in better years, and there are not many new seeds because of their drought. So these birds that had thicker beaks had survived, and they were noticeably thicker beaked in the next generation. So they were able to watch all sorts of, you know, small-scale changes happen in basically real time, in a year or two. But they spent close to 30 years of their lives mostly camped on that little tiny island, more of their time in the Galapagos than they were back in Princeton. So it's a very, and I have other examples in the book of these people who did very huge amounts of sacrifice in order to study evolution in the wild on a real-time scale. And the point being that we can actually watch evolution on real time. It's not something we just think about as hypothetical. It's actually been observed.
That's right.
It's easier to observe, of course, in microorganisms than in laboratories where most of the research is done, but field work. And all sorts of studies have seen evolution in all sorts of organisms at every scale.
So, well, and we're seeing evolution in COVID right now.
Right, right. So microorganisms, especially viruses, are famously flu bugs changed every year, and you can never be completely cured of the common cold because they always evolve faster than our immune system. But now we're experiencing in real time this COVID virus is finding new ways to evolve, and it's just a question of whether the way they built these vaccines is going to be able to stop the new ones as well as to stop the original ones.
There are so many cool parts of this book that I just loved reading. One of the things that was important for people to understand historically was realizing how many species inhabited the Earth. Because, you know, there was this idea of Noah's Ark. So Noah's Ark saved all the animals, and then, you know, the tides went out, the Ark docked, and all the animals left. But they started realizing that the geographic distribution of all these really odd animals, of which there were many, could not be explained by Noah's Ark.
That's right.
And you have people like Alfred Russel Wallace, who's a very important scientist that most people aren't familiar with.
Yeah, the whole idea of biogeography was a crucial piece of the evidence that Darwin, of course, developed because he had been on the Beagle Voyage and observed all these peculiar animals, and every continent had its own unique animals and its distinctive fauna. And that was by itself one of the best arguments against Noah's Ark, because, you know, and the Noah's Ark myth came down from the ancient Akkadian Sumerians. It was the Epic of Gilgamesh was the root for that, along with the Enuma Elish. Those ancient stories, which the Hebrews picked up, the only animals they knew of in the Middle East were just a handful of domesticated animals and a handful of wild animals. And to them, the world was very small. And yet the stories kept on going as people spread all over the world and encountered animals that no biblical person had ever seen. And by the late 1700s, there had been so many voyages of exploration around the world that they knew about the weird animals of Australia and the weird animals of South America and New Zealand and so on. And it was becoming more and more apparent you couldn't fit them into the Noah's Ark, nor would the Noah's Ark story make sense, because it would make no sense that they'd all migrated away from a spot in Turkey like Mount Ararat, and yet there were no, you know, kangaroos anywhere else except Australia, and all these other bizarre things that made no sense. And so effectively, by the 1820s, nobody in the scientific community or the scholarly community accepted the Noah's Ark story anymore. It was dead because all the evidence had shot it down. Darwin had nothing to do with that. It was all about not taking, you know, taking the evidence seriously from biogeography. And then Wallace, as you mentioned, was the key figure in this, because Wallace, unlike Darwin, was not a gentleman. He had no independent income, so he could do whatever he wanted with his time. He had to work for a living, and he went through a tremendous amount of struggle, you know, because he was not educated, well-educated, and so on. He was mostly self-taught. And his first expedition, 4 years in the Brazilian Amazon, ended up in a disaster, because on the way home, all these specimens he collected to make money, to make a living, were burned up when his ship was shipwrecked. And he lost everything except for a handful he'd already shipped ahead and a few other things, but he lost everything. And so he had to go right back out after he arrived in London, just shortly before Darwin's book was about to come out, or Darwin's ideas about the book come out. This is the other part of the story. And then he found himself in Indonesia for 8 years, all over the so-called Malay Archipelago, as it was called then. And again, the funky piece of history there was that he had the same inspiration about natural selection that Darwin had had from looking at almost the same evidence, and of all the people he mailed his letter with his ideas to, it was Darwin who received the letter in the mail, right? History's got these strange quirks, and this is one of them, because he knew Darwin was the man most interested in the topic. I mean, it was widely known that he was thinking about this, and so Darwin had a dilemma, because he'd been working on it for 20 years at this point, starting in 1838 when he got the letter, 1858, and he appealed to his good friends Joseph Hooker and Charles Lyell, who were by then, you know, best supporters, and told them the situation. They knew of his ideas because he'd written them down and shown them to him. And so they made a solution, which was in the middle of the summer of 1858, they had a meeting of the Linnaean Society. And they had these, you know, they scholars get up and read their presentations, and you know, they record them in the minutes, and they keep on going. And so they did that. They had Darwin's early sketches, and then Wallace's letter read into the minutes at the same meeting, so that they would have equal priority, equal credit for doing this. And then, of course, the minute this was over, it was all forgotten. It made no impression on anyone in that short meeting in 1858. But then Darwin realized he was about to be scooped, and that's when he stopped diddling around for 20 years procrastinating and wrote his book, which came out in November 1859. And so, anyway, that was the story behind that. So Wallace, you know, effectively, you know, was out in Indonesia, couldn't do anything about this. But when he got back, he was very gracious and very generous. He even entitled his own book about evolution, Darwinism. So he gave Darwin the, you know, lion's share of credit, because Darwin had been working on it longer and had written the book that had, you know, made this case. But then he effectively became the father of modern biogeography, because he wrote on the geographic distribution of animals shortly after he returned from Southeast Asia. And in those books that he did, that was the first one, he pulled together this wealth of knowledge that he built from being in the field for half his life in South America and in Indonesia at that point, and established most of the modern rules of biogeography. So he's the founder of biogeography, which is not such a slouch compared to most people's lives.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Donald R. Prothrow, paleontology and geology researcher, teacher, author, adjunct professor of geological sciences at California State Polytechnic University, Pomona. We're talking about his latest book, which is a great read. The Story of Evolution in 25 Discoveries, the Evidence and the People Who Found It. Don, another great thing to talk about. People may think they understand evolution, but the way they look at these representations, these linear representations that have an ape right. on the left side progressing up to humanity, they don't understand that evolution as we understand it now is more complex. It's not a ladder, it's a bush. And can you explain that?
Right. Yeah, the old idea, this march through time from simpler to more complex, actually goes back to Aristotle. So it's 2,000 plus years old. And it's this idea, you know, that there are lower forms of life, you know, like sponges and corals and so on, and that humans are at the top of this ladder. And, of course, it was very quickly tied into religious notions of the last 2,000 years, especially the idea that we're top of the ladder and then above us were the cherubim and then our angels and the archangels and, of course, God at the top. It was a religiously ordained hierarchy, and we were always sort of a step on that hierarchy. And that was still impressed on people for better than, you know, so late 1850s or so. And it was Darwin's book that upended that and pointed out that, in fact, life is not organized that way. Life is a branching sequence, and that you can have things branch off from their ancestors and live side by side. So once in a while you hear a person give a creationist thing like, well, if man evolved from apes, why are apes still around?
Right.
Which only shows they don't understand what evolution is. It's about branching out. And so the analogy I use when I get that argument is, well, why didn't your father die the minute you were born? Okay, and why didn't your grandfather die the minute your dad was born? That's not how it works. We're not part of a continuous transformation series. We're part of a series of branches, and we overlap in time. We overlap in lots of ways. And so this is the way life is, too. And what was clear from Darwin's work, and the only illustration he put in the book, was the branching tree of life. And the earliest sketches we have of his ideas show this little sketch of the branching tree of life. It was a key insight in what he was doing. And it was something that stymied all his predecessors, who just viewed it as a continuous, climbing up the ladder type of thing. And so that, and also this great chain of being, which is a similar metaphor for life, were very prevalent until Darwin's book came out. That's why, for example, when any one of us gets asked, well, but what about the missing link? You know, we cringe,
yeah.
Because that's an outdated concept from more than 150 years ago. There is no chain of life, and therefore no missing links. It's not a concept we even take seriously anymore. There are plenty of transitional fossils that show how various lineages evolve from each other. And that's not a problem. But, of course, you can never, never make a creationist happy in this regard, because you show them a bunch of transitions. They say, well, what about the fossils in between those?
Yeah, right.
Nothing's ever enough, right?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
More gaps produced. If you produce one specimen between two extremes, then they'll say, well, yeah, but now what about this one? What about this one? Yeah, that's obviously a loser argument. You can't even get into those kinds of debates.
Well, before we run out of time, and we will, I want to talk about, you have several great chapters on hominid evolution.
Yeah.
And it might surprise people to realize there were dozens of hominid species, and at any one time, several hominid species coexisted and were on the Earth, and sometimes in the same area.
Yep, that's something in anthropology and for research for human fossils has shown us, primarily in eastern Africa, especially Ethiopia and Kenya, and that is that, for a very long time, right up until the 80s or even 90s, anthropologists all sort of believed that humans could only have one species on the planet at one time like we have now, because the idea was that humans could never live side by side with another thing that was similar to us. You know, we always have warfare and competition, even with the members of our own species. And so this was something that sort of shoehorned them in again into this linear notion of from ape to man. This was something that was deeply embedded but never supported actually by evidence. And then the evidence, in fact, showed the opposite. And then there's places around Lake Turkana and northern Kenya and into Ethiopia where they have beds which have multiple hominid species from the same level. And that means they coexist at the same time. They're found pretty much in the same places. So that pretty much rules that old idea out. We were only one species of human on the planet at the time. And there are time intervals of as many as 5 or 6 in the same interval, and mostly in East Africa before we left that place.
So some of them were really, really huge. I think it was Homo ergaster. was really yep. tall. And then some of them, the one that they just recently, relatively recently discovered, Homo florensis.
Yeah, was a dwarf, yep.
Was
yep.
like, a, they nicknamed it the Hobbit. That was on an island in Indonesia. And that actually follows some of the laws of island biogeography.
Right, which Wallace discovered, of course.
Yeah.
The island of Flores is one of those I believe he went to. And Flores is where they discovered this very dwarfed human. It's not just a Homo sapiens pygmy or small individual. It's smaller than that and more primitive than that. So there's various arguments about how they fit in the human family tree, but they do fit the model that when you get to an island, it gets called insular dwarfism. Islands tend to make most large animals get smaller. We know this from lots of different elephants and mammoths. In fact, my student and I were doing research in this just last year. We know this from a bunch of other animals, pygmy hippos.
That's right. There was a pygmy elephant, I think, too, that was on an island.
That's right. And the basic idea behind that is it's thought that, you know, when you're in an island, especially as a large animal, you're probably less likely to encounter large predators, which may not live on that island. So you don't have to be giant to protect yourself. And especially for an elephant or something like that, you eat a lot of food when you're big. And islands tend to have less in the way total resources and less in the way total range area. So you have to adopt a sparser diet. So being a smaller body size is an advantage. You don't have to eat so much. And if you're in a place without predators, you don't need to get big. So those are the main ideas that have sort of triggered this type of thinking about insular dwarfism.
What is the story with the Denisovians?
Well, at the moment, as I understand it, the Denisovans have like one or two teeth known and a finger bone and maybe some other small parts. They keep looking for more, so eventually we may get some more pieces.
But where are they being found? Where are these fossils being found?
The Denisova cave is in what's now Russia, but it's right on the border with China. It's up in the mountains there north of the Himalayas and into, I believe, into Kazakhstan on the edge. But anyway, it's a cave. It's been explored mostly by Russian archaeologists, and it has a number of small pieces of humans in them. And if they had just been discovered as is, in other words, all they had were these few teeth and the finger bone and a few other things, nothing would have been said about them. It would have just been scraps. But they were able to extract DNA from these, and they did that, and sure enough, their DNA is different from any other hominid species known on the planet. They're Whoa. Different from Neanderthals, they're different from Homo sapiens. I mean, they have lots of overlap with us, but enough that their DNA is different enough that they're considered by everyone who studied it to be a different species of human. And the problem with naming it, giving it a name, Homo whatever, is that their specimens are so tiny and so scrappy that there's not enough physical evidence and not enough anatomical evidence to define what they mean. They're defined only by the genome that they recovered from them. So that's why they're still informally known as the Denisovans, because you really need an actual skull or at least a partial skull or something like that to name an animal in zoology, and just a tooth with a different DNA is not enough yet.
And finally, this brings up an important thing, that within the last 50 years, discoveries about the structure of DNA, how DNA works, the genome sequencing, DNA hybridization techniques have really aided evolution incredibly. Like comparing our DNA to chimpanzee DNA, how different are they?
Less than 1% now, or 1 to 2%, depending upon which part you're looking at. But effectively, so similar that Jared Diamond famously described humans as the third species of chimpanzee, because we have more similarity in DNA between us and the other two species of chimps than, say, lions and tigers have. They only have 95% of their DNA shared, and yet they can actually interbreed, we can't do with chimps. So it's a very, very tiny amount that controls everything else that's expressed in our genome and turns us from a chimp to a human, which, of course, since the 1920s, they've known about this, and they've had the speculation about what it might mean. And what's really cool is that genetics has just basically transformed everything we thought we knew about evolution. Darwin could never have guessed that every cell in your body has the same evolutionary branching sequence in its DNA that everything they knew about from the external anatomy of animals. And so since the 1980s and 90s, especially in this century, it's gotten routine to get complete DNA sequences for a lot of animals. And what it's showing is that almost everything we knew about how they were related based on their external anatomy is completely mirrored by what we know from their DNA. And other molecules as well, like mitochondria DNA and sometimes protein sequences, all of those have been used. And as it gets easier and gets cheaper, it's getting done more and more. What's really striking also about what we learned about DNA is not just the shock that we were that close to chimps, but other surprises. Like, for example, 80 to 90% of your DNA is junk. It's not red at all. It may or may not have any function as far as we can tell. And it carries in it tons and tons of DNA that's completely useless, that's never read. It's just sitting there, copied a long time ago, and then never weeded out, which is the way it works. And it's not a very well-engineered DNA. It just keeps a lot of old stuff around that's not used.
That brings up another great chapter of your book. We only have a couple of minutes, but are humans well-designed? Because you'll often hear that. You know, right.
And the
short answer is no.
No, very much so. And anyone who's a little older like myself will tell you that.
Oh, God. I'm older than you, I think. We're not well designed at all.
No. Your knees, your ankles, your hips, your back. We are not intended to be bipedal animals, or at least not well designed for it. Or ostrich is better at running than we are. And most animals that are bipedal have lots of adaptations. We don't. And so we have all sorts of problems that come primarily from being bipedal, and that's in, of course, our backs and our joints and everything like that. We're not adapted to pounding our joints as long as we do, and so we are always prone to knee and hip and back problems. And then it comes also from things like, for example, adopting speech and changing the configuration of our necks. So, for example, you have an epiglottis that separates your trachea from your esophagus, and you very carefully often end up inhaling food or wet drink, and then they need the Heimlich maneuver to save you, right? And lots of people used to die routinely from inhaling food and drink because of that clumsy design.
We also have vestigial features like the appendix.
Right, the appendix, there's a ton of things like that. It's not just physical vestiges, it's in your DNA as well.
That's right.
You have DNA from viral infections that go back to your distant ancestors that is no longer red. It's just sitting there, okay? It's just been left over. So these are what's called retroviral infections, which insert their DNA right into the host DNA, and they're still there. They're called endogenous retroviruses, ERV, and some of them go back to your chimp ancestors and your far distant ape ancestors and so on, and they're never weeded out. They just sit there. They don't work anymore. They can't produce a virus anymore, but they're the code of an old virus that may have infected your ancestor 50 million years ago.
I was just glad I was alive when I finished that chapter. We're completely out of time because I certainly felt that chapter. There's a quote in your book, "The proof of evolution is in every cell of our body." And I'm going to end the show on that. My returning guest tonight is Donald R. Prothero, paleontology and geology researcher, teacher, author. He's adjunct professor of geological sciences at California State Polytechnic University, Pomona. And we're talking about his latest book. It is really good. It's a fun read. The Story of Evolution and 25 Discoveries, the Evidence and the People Who Found It. Don, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.